as if to his own son. If you find a town, don't bring the girl in, or this will happen again. I turned and spat on his dark, stinking tunic, a gesture of powerlessness and despair. He caught my arm as I turned away. And get rid of that old man. He's worthless. He'll only wind up getting you and the girl killed. Chapter 5. They say that ghosts, sometimes, those that cannot let go their bond to the living, linger and haunt the scenes of their days under the sun, hovering like substanceless birds of carrion, refusing Hades' command to retire beneath the earth. That is how we lived, Bruxius, Diomache, and I, in the weeks following the sack of our city. For a month and more, for most of that summer, we could not quit our vacated polis. We roamed the wild country above the Agrotera, the marginal wastes surrounding the cropland, sleeping in the day when it was warm, moving at night, like the shades we were. From the ridgelines, we watched the Argives move in below, repopulating our groves and farmsteads with the excess of their citizenry. Diomache was not the same. She would wander away by herself into the dark glades and do unspeakable things to her womanly parts. She was trying to dispatch the child that might be growing inside her. "She thinks she has given offense to the god Hymen," Bruxius explained to me when I broke in upon her one day, and she chased me with curses and a hail of stones. "She fears that she may never be a man's wife now, but only a slave or a whore. I have tried to tell her this is foolishness, but she will not hear it, coming from a man." There were many others like us in the hills then. We would run into them at the springs and try to resume the fellow feeling we had shared as Astakiotes. But the extinction of our polis had severed those happy bonds forever. It was every man for himself now, every clan, every kin group. Some boys I knew had formed a gang. There were 11 of them, none more than 2 years older than I, and they were holy terrors. They carried arms and boasted that they had killed grown men. They beat me up one day when I refused to join them. I wanted to, but I couldn't leave Diomache. They would have taken her in too, but I knew she would never go near them. "This is our country," their boy lord warned me, a beast of 12, who called himself Sphyrius, ball player. Because he had stuffed in hide the skull of an Argive he had slain, and now kicked about with him the way a monarch bears a sceptron. He meant his gang's country, the high ground above the city beyond the reach of Argive armor. "If we catch you trespassing here again, you or your cousin or that slave, we'll cut out your liver and feed it to the dogs." At last, in fall, we put our city behind us. In September, when Boreas, the north wind, begins to blow, without Bruxius and his knowledge of roots and snares, we would have starved. Before, on my father's farm, we had caught wild birds for our coat, or to make breeding pairs, or just to hold for an hour before returning them to freedom. Now, we ate them. Bruxius made us devour everything but the feathers. We crunched the little hollow bones. We ate the eyes and the legs right down to the boot, discarding only the beak and the unchewable feet. We gulped eggs raw. We choked down worms and slugs. We wolfed grubs and beetles and fought over the last lizards and snakes before the cold drove them underground for good. We gnawed so much fennel that to this day I gag at a whiff of that anisey smell, even a pinch flavoring a stew. Diomache grew thin as a reed. "Why won't you talk to me any more?" I asked her one night as we tramped across some stony hillside. "Can't I put my head in your lap like we used to?" She began to cry and would not answer me. I had made myself an infantryman's spear, stout ash and fire-hardened, no longer a boy's toy, but a weapon meant to kill. Visions of revenge fed my heart. I would live among the Spartans. I would slay Argives one day. I practiced the way I had seen our warriors do, advancing as if on line, an imaginary shield before me at high port, my spear gripped strong above the right shoulder, poised for the overhand strike. I looked up one dusk, and there stood my cousin, observing me coldly. "You will be like them," she said, "when you grow." She meant the soldiers who had shamed her. "I will not." "You will be a man. You won't be able to help yourself." One night when we had tramped for hours, Bruxius inquired of Diomache why she had held herself so silent. He was concerned for the dark thoughts that might be poisoning her mind. She refused to speak at first, then, at last, relenting, told us in a sweet, sad voice of her wedding. She had been planning it in her head all night, what dress she would wear, what style of garland, which goddess she would dedicate her sacrifice to. She had been thinking for hours, she told us, of her slippers. She had all the strapping and beadwork worked out in her mind. They would be so beautiful, her bridal slippers. Then her eyes clouded and she looked away. "This shows what a fool I have become. No one will marry me." "I will," I proffered at once. She laughed. "You? A fair chance of that." Foolish as it sounds to recount, to my boy's heart these careless words stung like no others in my life. I vowed that I would marry Diomache one day. I would be man enough and warrior enough to protect her. For a time in autumn we tried surviving on the seacoast, sleeping in caves and combing the sloughs and marshes. You could eat there, at least. There were shellfish and crabs, mussels and spinebacks to be prized from rocks. We learned how to take gulls on the wing with stakes and nets. But the exposure was brutal as winter came on. Bruxius began to suffer. He would never let his weakness show to Diomache and me when he thought we were looking, but I would watch his face sometimes when he slept. He looked 70. The elements were hard on him in his years. All the old wounds ached. But more than that, he was donating his substance to preserve ours, Diomache's and mine. Sometimes I would catch him looking at me, studying a tilt to my face or the tone of something I had said. He was making sure I hadn't gone crazy or feral. As the cold came on, it became more difficult to find food. We must beg. Bruxius would pick out an isolated farmstead and approach the gate alone. The hounds would converge in a clamorous pack, and the men of the farm would emerge on guard from the fields or from some rude falling-down outbuilding. Brothers and a father, their calloused hands resting on the tools which would become weapons if the need arose. The hills were infested with outlaws then. The farmers never knew who would walk up to their gate and with what duplicitous intent. Bruxius would doff his cap and wait for the woman of the house, making sure she took note of his milky eyes and beaten posture. He would indicate Diomache and me, shivering miserably in the road, and ask the mistress not for food, which would have made us beggars in the landsmen's eyes and prompted them loosing the dogs on us, but for any broken item of use that she could spare, a rake, a thrashing staff, a worn-out cloak, something we could repair and sell in the next town. He made sure to ask directions and appear eager to be moving on. That way they knew any kindness would not make us linger. Almost always the farm wives volunteered a meal, sometimes inviting us in to hear what news we bore from foreign places and to tell us their own. It was during one of those forlorn feedings that I first heard the word sepea. "This is a place of Argos, a wooded area near Tiryns, where a battle had just been fought between the Argives and the Spartans. The boy who bore this tale was a farmer's visiting nephew, a mute who communicated through signs and whom even his own family could barely comprehend. The Spartans, under King Cleomenes, the boy gave us to understand, had achieved a spectacular victory. 2,000 Argives dead was one figure he had heard, though others had it at 4,000 and even 6. My heart exploded with joy. How I wished I could have been there, to have been a man grown, advancing in that battle line, mowing down in fair fight the men of Argos, as they had cut down by perfidy my own mother and father. The Spartans became for me the equivalent of avenging gods. I couldn't learn enough about these warriors who had so devastatingly defeated the murderers of my mother and father, the violators of my innocent cousin. No stranger we met escaped my boyish grilling. Tell me about Sparta, her double kings, the 300 knights who protected them, the agoge, which trained the city's youth, the Sisseteia, the warriors' messes. We heard a tale of Cleomenes. Someone had asked the king why he did not raise Argos once and for all when his army had stood at the gates and the city lay prostrate before him. "We need the Argives," Cleomenes responded. "Who else will our young men train on?" In the winter hills we were starving. Bruxius was getting weaker. I took to stealing. Diomache and I would raid a shepherd's fold at night, fighting off the dogs with sticks and snatching a kid if we could. Most of the shepherds carried bows. Arrows would whiz past us in the dark. We stopped to grab them and soon had quite a cache. Bruxius hated to see us turning into thieves. We got a bow one time, snagging it right out from under a sleeping goatherd's nose. It was a man's weapon, a Thessalian cavalry bow, so stout that neither Diomache nor I could draw it. Then came the event which changed my life and set it on the course that reached its terminus at the Hot Gates. I got caught stealing a goose. She was a fat prize, her wings pegged for market, and I got careless going over a wall. The dogs got me. The men of the farm dragged me into the mud of the livestock pen and nailed me to a hide board the size of a door, driving tanning spikes through both my palms. I was on my back, screaming in agony, while the farm men lashed my kicking, flailing legs to the board, vowing that after lunch they would castrate me like a sheep and hang my testicles upon the gate as a warning to other thieves. Diomache and Bruxius crouched, hidden up the hillside. They could hear everything. Here the captive drew up in his narration. Fatigue and the ordeal of his wounds had taken severe toll of the man, or perhaps his listeners imagined it was memory of the instance he was recounting. His Majesty, through the Captain Orontes, inquired of the prisoner if he required attention. The man declined. The hesitation in the tale, he declared, arose not from any incapacity of its narrator, but at the prompting of the god by whose inner direction the order of events was being dictated, and who now commanded a momentary alteration of tack. The man Zeonis resettled himself and granted permission to wet his throat with wine, resumed. 2 summers subsequent to this incident, in Lacedaemon, I witnessed a different kind of ordeal. A Spartan boy beaten to death by his drill instructors. The lad's name was Teriander. He was 14. They called him Tripod because no one of his age class could take him down in wrestling. Over the succeeding years I looked on in attendance as 2 dozen other boys succumbed beneath this same trial, each like Tripod, disdaining so much as a whimper in pain, but he, this lad, was the first. The whippings are a ritual of the boys' training in Lacedaemon, not in punishment for stealing food, at which exploit the boys are encouraged to excel, to develop resourcefulness in war, but for the crime of getting caught. The beatings take place alongside the temple of Artemis Orthia, in a narrow alley called the Runway. The site is beneath plane trees, a shaded and quite pleasant space in less grisly circumstances. Tripod was the 11th boy whipped that day. The 2 Aeranes, drill instructors, who administered the beatings had already been replaced by a fresh pair, 20-year-olds, just out of the agoge, and as powerfully built as any youths in the city. It worked like this. The boy whose turn it was grasped a horizontal iron bar secured to the bases of 2 trees, The bar had been worn smooth by decades, some said centuries, of the ritual, and was flogged with birch rods as big around as a man's thumb by the Erinnes taking turns. A priestess of Artemis stood at the boy's shoulder, presenting an ancient wooden image which must, tradition dictated, receive the spray of human blood. Two of the boy's mates from his training platoon kneel at each shoulder to catch the lad when he falls. At any time the boy may terminate the ordeal by releasing the bar and pitching forward to the dirt. Theoretically, a boy would only do this when thrashed to unconsciousness, but many pitched simply when they could no longer bear the pain. Between 100 and 200 looked on this day, boys of other platoons, fathers, brothers, and mentors, and even some of the boys' mothers keeping discreetly to the rear. Tripod kept taking it and taking it. The flesh of his back had been torn through in a dozen places. You could see the tissue and the fascia, rib cage and muscle, and even the spine. He would not go down. Pitch, his two comrades kept urging between blows, meaning let go of the bar and fall. Tripod refused. Even the drill instructors began hissing this between their teeth. One look in the boy's face, and you could see he had passed beyond reason. He had made up his mind to die rather than raise the hand for quarter. The Erinnes did as they were instructed in such cases. They prepared to wallop Tripod so hard in 4 rapid successive blows that the impact would knock him unconscious and thus preserve his life. I will never forget the sound those 4 blows made upon the boy's back. Tripod dropped. The drill instructors immediately declared the ordeal terminated and summoned the next boy. Tripod managed to lift himself upon all 4s. Blood was sheeting from his mouth, nose, and ears. He could not see or speak. He managed somehow to turn about and almost stand. Then he sank slowly to his seat, held there a moment, and then dropped hard into the dirt. It was clear at once that he would never rise. Later that evening, when it was over, the ritual was not suspended on account of Tripod's death, but continued for another 3 hours. Dianeces, who had been present, walked apart with his protege, the boy Alexandros, whom I mentioned earlier. I served Alexandros at this time. He was 12, but looked no older than 10. Already he was a wonderful runner, but extremely slight and of a sensitive disposition. Moreover, he had shared a bond of affection with Tripod. The older boy had been a sort of guardian or protector. Alexandros was devastated by his death. Dianeces walked with Alexandros, alone except for his own squire and myself, to a spot beneath the temple of Athena, protectress of the city, immediately below the slope from the statue of Phobos, the god of fear. At that time, Dianeces' age was, I would estimate, 35 years. He had already won 2 prizes of valor, at Erythrae against the Thebans, and at Achilleion against the Corinthians and their Arcadian allies. As nearly as I can recall, this is how the older man instructed his protege. First, in a gentle and loving tone, he recalled his own first sight when he was a lad in years younger even than Alexandros, of a boy comrade whipped to death. He recounted several of his own ordeals in the runway beneath the rod. Then he began the sequence of query and response which comprises the Lacedaemonian syllabus of instruction. Answer this, Alexandros. When our countrymen triumph in battle, what is it that defeats the foe? The boy responded in the terse Spartan style. Our steel and our skill. These, yes, Dianeces corrected him gently, but something more. It is that. His gesture led up the slope to the image of Phobos. Fear, their own fear, defeats our enemies. Now, answer, what is the source of fear? When Alexandros's reply faltered, Dianeces reached with his hand and touched his own chest and shoulder. Fear arises from this, the flesh. This, he declared, is the factory of fear. Alexandros listened with the grim concentration of a boy who knows his whole life will be war, that the laws of Lycurgus forbid him and every other Spartan to know or pursue a trade other than war, that his term of obligation extends from age 20 to age 60, and that no force under heaven will excuse him from soon, very soon, assuming his place in line of battle and clashing shield to shield, helmet to helmet with the enemy. Now answer again, Alexandros. Did you observe today, in the manner of the Erinnes delivering the beating, any sign or indication of malice? The boy answered no. Would you characterize their demeanor as barbarous? Did they take pleasure in dealing agony to Tripod? No. Was their intention to crush his will or break his spirit? No. What was their intention? To harden his mind against pain. Throughout this conversation, the older man maintained a voice tender and solicitous with love. Nothing Alexandros could do would ever make this voice love him less or abandon him. Such is the peculiar genius of the Spartan system of pairing each boy in training with a mentor other than his own father. A mentor may say things that a father cannot. A boy can confess to his mentor that which would bring shame to reveal to his father. It was bad today, wasn't it, my young friend? Dianeces then asked the boy how he imagined battle, real battle, compared with what he had witnessed today. No answer was required or expected. Never forget, Alexandros, that this flesh, this body, does not belong to us. Thank God it doesn't. If I thought this stuff was mine, I could not advance a pace into the face of the enemy. But it is not ours, my friend. It belongs to the gods and to our children, our fathers and mothers and those of Lacedaemon, 100, 1,000 years yet unborn. It belongs to the city which gives us all we have and demands no less in requital. Man and boy moved on down the slope to the river. They followed the path to that grove of double-boled myrtle called the Twins, sacred to the sons of Tyndareus and to the family to which Alexandros belonged. It would be to this spot, on the night of his final ordeal and initiation, that he would repair, alone save his mother and sisters, to receive the salve and sanction of the gods of his line. Dianeces sat upon the earth beneath the Twins. He gestured to Alexandros to take the place beside him. Personally, I think your friend Tripod was foolish. What he displayed today contained more of recklessness than true courage, Andrea. He cost the city his life, which could have been spent more fruitfully in battle. Nonetheless, it was clear Dianeces respected him. But to his credit, he showed us something of nobility today. He showed you and every boy watching what it is to pass beyond identification with the body, beyond pain, beyond fear of death. You were horrified to behold his agonisma, but it was awe that struck you, really, wasn't it? Awe of that boy, or whatever daimon animated him. Your friend Tripod showed us contempt for this. Again Dianeces indicated the flesh, a contempt which approached the stature of the sublime. From my spot above on the bank I could see the boy's shoulders shudder as the grief and terror of the day at last purged themselves from his heart. Dianeces embraced and comforted him. When at last the boy had recomposed himself, his mentor gently released him. Have your instructors taught you why the Spartans excuse without penalty the warrior who loses his helmet or breastplate in battle, but punish with loss of all citizenship rights the man who discards his shield? They had, Alexandros replied. Because a warrior carries helmet and breastplate for his own protection, but his shield for the safety of the whole line. Dionyces smiled and placed a hand upon his protege's shoulder. Remember this, my young friend. There is a force beyond fear, more powerful than self-preservation. You glimpsed it today, in a crude and unself-aware form, yes, but it was there, and it was genuine. Let us remember your friend Tripod, and honor him for this. I was screaming upon the hideboard. I could hear my cries bounce off the walls of the livestock enclosure and shriek off, multiplied, up the hillsides. I knew it was disgraceful, but I could not stop. I begged the farm men to release me, to end my agony. I would do anything, and I described it all at the top of my lungs. I cried out to the gods in a shameful little boy's voice, piping up the mountainside. I knew Bruxius could hear me. Would his love for me impel him to dash in and be nailed alongside me? I didn't care. I wanted the pain to end. I begged the men to kill me. I could feel the bones in both hands shattered by the spikes. I would never hold a spear or even a gardening spade. I would be a cripple, a club fist. My life was over, and in the meanest, most dishonorable way. A fist shattered my cheek. Shut your pipe hole, you sniveling little shitworm. The men set the tanning board upright, angled against a wall, and there I squirmed, impaled, for the sun's endless crawl across the sky. Urchins from the up-valley farms clustered to watch me scream. The girls tore my rags and poked at my privates. The boys pissed on me. Dogs snuffed my bare soles, emboldening themselves to make a meal of me. I only stopped wailing when my throat could cry no longer. I was trying to tear my palms free right through the spikes, but the men lashed my wrists tighter so I couldn't move. "How does that feel, you fucking thief? Let's see you pick off another prize, you night-creeping little rat." When at last their own growling bellies drove my tormentors indoors for supper, Diomache slipped down from the hill and cut me free. The spikes would not come out of my palms. She had to blade the wood off the frame with her dagger. My hands came away with the tanning nails still through them. Bruxius carried me off, as he had borne Diomache earlier after her violation. "Oh, God," my cousin said, when she saw my hands. Chapter 6. That winter, Bruxius said, was the coldest he could remember. Sheep froze in the high pastures. 20-foot drifts sealed the passes. Deer were driven so desperate with hunger that they straggled down, skeleton-thin and blind from starvation, all the way to the shepherds' winter folds where they presented themselves for slaughter, point-blank before the herdsmen's bows. We stayed in the mountains, so high up that martens and foxes' fur grew white as the snow. We slept in dugouts that shepherds had abandoned, or in ice caves we chopped out with stone axes, lining their floors with pine boughs, and huddling together beneath our triple cloaks in a pile, like puppies. I begged Bruxius and Diomache to abandon me, let me die in peace in the cold. They insisted that I allow them to carry me down to a town, to a physician. I refused, absolutely. Never again would I place myself before a stranger, any stranger, without a weapon in my hand. Did Bruxius imagine that doctors possessed a more exalted sense of honor than other men? What payment would some hill-town quack demand? What profitable turn would he discover in a slave and a crippled boy? What use would he make of a starving 13-year-old girl? I had another reason for refusing to go to a town. I hated myself for the shameless way I had cried out, and could not make myself stop during the hours I was put to the trial. I had seen my own heart, and it was the heart of a coward. I despised myself with a blistering, pitiless scorn. The tales I had cherished of the Spartans only made me loathe myself more. None of them would beg for his life as I had, absent every scrap of dignity. The dishonor of my parents' murder continued to torment me. Where was I in their hour of desperation? I was not there when they needed me. In my mind, I imagined their slaughter again and again, and always myself absent. I wanted to die. The only thought that lent me solace was the certainty that I would die soon, and thereby exit this hell of my own dishonored existence. Bruxius intuited these thoughts, and tried in his gentle way to disarm them. I was only a child, he told me. What prodigies of valor could be expected from a lad of 10? Boys are men at 10 in Sparta, I declared. This was the first and only time I saw Bruxius truly physically angry. He seized me by both shoulders and shook me violently, commanding me to face him. Listen to me, boy. Only gods and heroes can be brave in isolation. A man may call upon courage only one way, in the ranks, with his brothers in arms, the line of his tribe and his city. Most piteous of all states under heaven is that of a man alone, bereft of the gods of his home and his polis. A man without a city is not a man, he is a shadow, a shell, a joke, and a mockery. That is what you have become now, my poor Zeo. No one may expect valor from one cast out alone, cut off from the gods of his home. He drew up then. His eyes broke away in sorrow. I saw the slave brand upon his brow. I understood. Such was the state he had endured all these years in the house of my father. But you have acted the man, little old uncle, I said, employing the fondest Astakia term of affection. How have you done it? He looked at me with sad, gentle eyes. The love I might have given my own children, I gave to you, little nephew. That was my answer to the unknowable ways of God, but it seems the Argives are dearer to him than I. He has let them rob me of my life not once, but twice. These words, intended to bring comfort, only reinforced further my resolve to die. My hands had swollen now to twice their normal size. Pus and poison oozed from them, then froze in a hideous icy mass that I had to chip away each morning to reveal the mangled flesh beneath. Bruxius did everything he could with salves and poultices, but it was no use. Both central metacarpals had been shattered in my right hand. I could not close the fingers nor form a fist. I would never hold a spear, nor grip a sword. Diomache sought to comfort me by equating my ruin to hers. I scorned her bitterly. You can still be a woman. What can I do? How can I ever take my place in the line of battle? At night, bouts of fever alternated with fits of teeth-rattling ague. I curled, contorted in Diomache's arms, with Bruxius's bulk enwrapping us both for warmth. I called out again and again to the gods, but received no whisper in reply. They had abandoned us, it was clear, now that we no longer possessed ourselves or were possessed by our polis. One fever-racked night, perhaps 10 days after the incident at the farmstead, Diomache and Bruxius wrapped me in skins and set off foraging. It had begun to snow, and they hoped to use the silence, perhaps with luck to take unawares a hare or a gone-to-ground covey of grouse. This was my chance. I resolved to take it. I waited till Bruxius and Diomache had moved off beyond sight and sound. Leaving cloak and furs and foot-wraps behind for them, I set out barefoot into the storm. I climbed for what seemed like hours, but was probably no more than 5 minutes. The fever had me in its grip. I was blind like the deer, yet guided by an infallible sense of direction. I found a place amid a stand of pines and knew this was my spot. A profound sense of decorum possessed me. I wanted to do this properly and, above all, to be no trouble to Bruxius and Diomache. I picked out a tree and settled my back against it so that its spirit, which touched both earth and sky, would conduct mine safely out of this world. Yes, this was the tree. I could feel sleep, brother of death, advancing up from the toes. Feeling ebbed from my loins and midsection. When the numbness reaches the heart, I imagined, I will pass over. Then A terrifying thought struck me. What if this is the wrong tree? Perhaps I should be leaning against that one. Or that other over there. A panic of indecision seized me. I was in the wrong spot. I had to get up, but could no longer command my limbs to move. I groaned. I was failing even in my own death. Just as my panic and despair reached their apex, I was startled to discover a man standing directly above me in the grove. My first thought was that he could help me move. He could advise me, help me decide. Together we would pick out the correct tree, and he would place my back against it. From some part of my mind, the numb thought arose, what is a man doing up here at this hour in this storm? I blinked, and tried with all my failing power to focus. No, this was not a dream. Whoever this was, he was really here. The thought came foggily that he must be a god. It occurred to me that I was acting impiously toward him. I was giving offense. Surely propriety demanded that I respond with terror or awe, or prostrate myself before him. Yet something in his posture, which was not grave but oddly whimsical, seemed to say, "Don't give yourself the bother." I accepted this. It seemed to please him. I knew he was going to speak, and that whatever words came forth would be of paramount importance for me in this, my earthly life, or the life I was about to pass into. I must listen with all my faculties and forget nothing. His eyes met mine with a gentle, amused kindness. "I have always found the spear to be..." He spoke with a quiet majesty that could be nothing other than the voice of a god. "A rather inelegant weapon." What a queer thing to say, I thought. And why inelegant? I had the sense that the word was absolutely deliberate, the one precise term the god sought. It seemed to carry significance for him in level upon level, though I myself had no idea what this meaning could be. Then I saw the silver bow slung over his shoulder. The archer. Apollo Far Striker. In a flash that was neither thunderbolt nor revelation, but the plainest, least adorned apprehension in the world, I understood all that his words and presence implied. I knew what he meant, and what I must do. My right hand, its severed sinews would never produce the warrior's grasp upon the shank of a spear, but its forefingers could catch and draw the twined gut of a bowstring. My left, though ever denied power to close upon the grip cord of a hoplon shield, could yet hold stable the handpiece of a bow and extend it to full stretch. The bow would preserve me. The archer's eyes probed mine gently for one final instant. Had I understood? His glance seemed to inquire not so much, "Will you now serve me?" as to confirm the fact unknown to me heretofore that I had been in his service all my life. I felt warmth returning to my midsection, and the blood surging like a tide into my legs and feet. I heard my name being called from below, and knew it was my cousin, she and Bruxius, in alarm, scouring the hillside for me. Diomache reached me, scrabbling over the snowy crest and lurching into the grove of pines. "What are you doing up here all alone?" I could feel her slapping my cheeks, hard, as if to bring me around from a vision or transport. She was crying, clutching and hugging me, tearing off her cloak to wrap about me. She called back to Bruxius, who, in his blindness, was clambering as fast as he could up the slope below. "I'm all right," I heard my voice assuring her. She slapped me again, and then, weeping, cursed me for being such a fool and scaring them so to death. "It's all right, Dio," I heard my voice repeating. "I'm all right." Chapter 7. I beg His Majesty's patience with this recounting of the events following the sack of a city of which he has never heard, an obscure polis, without fame, spawner of no hero of legend, without link to the greater events of the present war and of the battle which His Majesty's forces fought with the Spartans and their allies at the pass of Thermopylae. My intent is simply to convey, through the experiences of two children and a slave, some poor measure of the soul terror and devastation which a vanquished population, any population, is forced to endure in the hour of its nation's extinction. For though His Majesty has commanded the sack of empires, yet, if one may speak plainly, He has witnessed the sufferings of their peoples only at a remove. From atop a purple throne, or mounted on a caparisoned stallion, protected by the gold-pummeled spears of His royal guard. Over the following decade, more than 60 battles, campaigns, and wars were fought between and among the cities of Greece. At least 40 poleis, including such impregnably founded citadels as Cnidus, Arethusa, Colonia, Amphissa, and Metropolis, were sacked in whole or in part. Numberless farms were torched, temples burned, warships sunk, men-at-arms slaughtered, wives and daughters carried off into slavery. No Hellene, however mighty his city, could state with certainty that even one season hence he would still find himself above the earth, with his head still upon his shoulders, and his wife and children slumbering in safety by his side. This state of affairs was unexceptional, neither better nor worse than any era in 1,000 years, back to Achilles and Hector, Theseus and Heracles, to the birth of the gods themselves. Business as usual, as the emporoi, the merchants, say. Each man of Greece knew what defeat in war meant, and knew that sooner or later that bitter broth would complete its circuit of the table and settle at last before his own place. Suddenly, with the rise of His Majesty in Asia, it seemed that hour would be sooner. Terror of the sack spread throughout all Greece, as word began coming, from the lips of too many to be disbelieved, of the scale of His Majesty's mobilization in the East, and his intent to put all Hellas to the torch. So all-pervasive was this dread, that it had even been given a name. Phobos, the fear. Fear of you, your majesty. Terror of the wrath of Xerxes, son of Darius, great king of the Eastern Empire, lord of all men from the rising to the setting sun, and the myriads all Greece knew were on the march beneath his banner to enslave us. 10 years had passed since the sack of my own city, yet the terror of that season lived on indelible within me. I was 19 now. Events which will in their course be related had parted me from my cousin and from Bruxius, and carried me, as was my wish, to Lacedaemon, and there, after a time, into the service of my master, Dienikes of Sparta. In this capacity I was dispatched, myself and a trio of other squires, in attendance upon him and 3 other Spartiate envoys, Olympias, Polynices, and Aristodemus, to the island of Rhodes, a possession of His Majesty's empire. It was there that these warriors and I myself glimpsed for the first time a fraction of the armored might of Persia. The ships came first. I had been given the afternoon free, and, making use of the time to learn what I could of the island, had attached myself to a company of Rhodian slingers in their practice. I watched as these ebullient fellows hurled with astonishing velocity their lead sling bullets thrice the size of a man's thumb. They could drill these murderous projectiles through 1/2-inch pine planks at 100 paces and strike a target the size of a man's chest 3 times out of 4. One among them, a youth my own age, was showing me how the slingers carved with their dagger points into the soft lead of their bullets whimsical greetings, "Eat this," or "Love and kisses," when another of the platoon looked up and pointed out to the horizon toward Egypt. We saw sails, perhaps a squadron, at least an hour out. The slingers forgot them and continued their drill. What seemed like moments later, the same fellow sang out again, this time with startlement and awe. All drew up and stared. Here came the squadron, triple bankers, with their sails brailed up for speed, already turning the cape and bearing fast upon the breakwater. None had ever seen vessels of such size moving so fast. They must be skimmers, someone said, racing shells. No full-size ship, and certainly no man-of-war could slice the water at speeds like that. But they were warships. Tyrian triremes, so tight to the surface that the swells seemed to crest no more than a hand-breadth beneath their thalamites benches. They were racing each other for sport beneath His Majesty's banner, training for Greece, for war. For the day their bronze-sheathed rams would send the navies of Hellas to the bottom. That evening Deinochus and the other envoys made their way on foot to the harbor at Lindos. The warships were drawn up upon the strand within a perimeter manned by Egyptian marines. These recognized the Spartans by their scarlet cloaks and long hair. A wry scene ensued. The captain of the marines motioned the Spartiates forward, calling them forth with a smile from the throng who had assembled to gawk at the vessels, and taking them through a full inspecting admiral's tour. The men speculated, through an interpreter, about how soon they would be at war with each other, and whether fate would bring them again face to face across the line of slaughter. The Egyptian marines were the tallest men I had ever seen, and burned nearly black by the sun of their desert land. They were under arms, in doeskin boots, with bronze fish-scale cuirasses and ostrich plume helmets detailed with gold. Their weapons were the pike and scimitar. They were in high spirits, these marines, comparing the muscles of their buttocks and thighs with those of the Spartans, while each laughed in his tongue, unintelligible to the other. "Pleased to meet you, you hyena-jawed bastards," Deinochus grinned at the captain, speaking in Doric, and clapping the fellow warmly upon the shoulder. "I'm looking forward to carving your balls and sending them home in a basket." The Egyptian laughed, uncomprehending, and replied, beaming, with some foreign-tongued insult, no doubt equally menacing and obscene. Deinochus asked the captain's name, which the man replied was Tamiticus. The Spartan tongue was defeated by this and settled upon Tommy, which seemed to please the officer just as well. He was asked how many more warships like these the great king numbered in his navy. 60, came the translated response.
60 ships? Asked Aristodemus.
The Egyptian loosed a brilliant smile. 60 squadrons. The marines conducted the Spartans upon a more detailed examination of the warships, which, hauled up on the sand, had been canted onto careening beams, exposing the undersides of their hulls for cleaning and sealing, which chores the Tyrian seamen were now enthusiastically performing. I smelled wax. The sailors were greasing the boats' bellies for speed. The vessel's planks were butted end to end with mortise and tenon joinery of such precision that it seemed the work not of shipwrights, but of master cabinet makers. The conjoining plates between the ram and the hull were glazed with speed-enhancing ceramic and waxed with some kind of naphtha-based oil which the mariners applied molten with paddles. Alongside these speedsters, the Spartan state galley Orthia looked like a garbage scow. But the items which commanded the most animated attention bore no bearing to concerns of the sea. These were the male loincloths worn by the marines to protect their private parts. "What are these, diapers?" Deinochus inquired, laughing and tugging at the hem of the captain's corselet. "Be careful, my friend," the marine responded with a mock theatric gesture. "I have heard about you Greeks." The Egyptian inquired of the Spartans why they wore their hair so long. Olympias replied, quoting the lawmaker Lycurgus, "Because no other adornment makes a handsome man more comely or an ugly one more terrifying, and it's free." The marine next began teasing the Spartans about their notoriously short Xiphos swords, He refused to believe that these were the actual weapons the Lacedaemonians carried into battle. They must be toys. How could such diminutive apple corers possibly work harm to an enemy? The trick is, Deianakes demonstrated, pressing himself chest to chest to the Egyptian Tommy, to get nice and cozy. When they parted, the Spartans presented the Marines with two skins of Falerian wine, the finest they had, a gift intended for the Rhodian consulate. The Marines gave each Spartan a gold darik, a month's pay for a Greek oarsman, and a sack apiece of fresh Nile pomegranates. The mission returned to Sparta unsuccessful. The Rhodians, as His Majesty knows, are Dorian Hellenes. They speak a dialect similar to the Lacedaemonians and call their gods by the same Doric-derived names. But their island had been since before the First Persian War a protectorate of the empire. What option other than submission did the Rhodians possess, their nation lying as it does within the very shadow of the masts of the imperial fleet? The Spartan embassy had sought, against all expectation, to detach through ancient bonds of kinship some portion of the Rhodian navy from service to His Majesty. It found no takers. Nor had there been, our embassy learned upon its return to the mainland, from simultaneous missions dispatched to Crete, Kos, Chios, Lesbos, Samos, Naxos, Imbros, Samothrace, Thasos, Skyros, Mykonos, Paros, Tinos, and Lemnos. Even Delos, birthplace of Apollo himself, had offered tokens of submission to the Persian. Phobos. This terror could be inhaled in the air of Andros, where we touched upon the voyage home. One felt it like a sweat on the skin at Chios and Hermione, where no harbor inn or beaching ground lacked for ships' masters and oarsmen with terror-inspiring tales of the scale of mobilization in the East and eyewitness reports of the uncountable myriads of the enemy. Phobos. This stranger accompanied the embassy as it landed at Thyrea and began the dusty 2-day hump across Parnon to Lacedaemon. Trekking up the eastern massive, the envoys could see landsmen and city folk evacuating their possessions to the mountains. Boys drove asses laden with sacks of corn and barley, protected by the men of the family under arms. Soon the old ones and the children would follow. In the high country, clan groups were burying jars of wine and oil, building sheepfolds and carving crude shelters out of the cliffsides. Phobos. At the frontier fort of Carii, our party fell in with an embassy from the Greek city of Plataea, a dozen men, including a mounted escort, headed for Sparta. Their ambassador was the hero Arimnestos of Marathon. It was said that this gentleman, though well past 50, had in that famous victory 10 years past waded in full armor into the surf, slashing with his sword at the oars of the Persian triremes as they backed water, fleeing for their lives. The Spartans loved this sort of thing. They insisted on Arimnestos's party joining ours for supper and accompanying us on the remaining march to the city itself. The Plataean shared his intelligence of the enemy. The Persian army, he reported, comprised of 2 million men drawn from every nation of the empire, had assembled at the great king's capital, Susa, in the previous summer. The force had advanced to Sardis and wintered there. From this site, as the greenest lieutenant could not fail to project, the myriads would proceed north along the coast highways of Asia Minor, through Aeolus and the Troad, crossing the Hellespont by either bridge of boats or massive ferrying operation, then proceed west, traversing Thrace and the Chersonese, southwest across Macedonia, and then south, into Thessaly, Greece proper. The Spartans recounted what they had learned at Rhodes, that the Persian army was already on the march from Sardis. The main body stood even now at Abydos, readying to cross the Hellespont. They would be in Europe within a month. At Silesia, a messenger from the Ephors in Sparta awaited my master with an ambassadorial pouch.
Deianakes was to detach himself from the party and proceed at once to Olympia. He took his leave at the Pelana Road, and, accompanied by myself alone, set out at a fast march, intending to cover the 50 miles in 2 days. It is not uncommon upon these treks to have fall in with one, as he tramps, various high-spirited hounds, and even half-wild urchins of the vicinity. Sometimes these carefree comrades remain on the troop all day, trotting in merry converse at the tracker's heels. Deianakes loved these ranging strays and never failed to welcome them and take cheer in their serendipitous companionship. This day, however, he sternly dismissed all we encountered, canine as well as human, striding resolutely onward, glancing neither left nor right. I had never seen him so troubled or so grave. An incident had occurred at Rhodes, which I felt certain lay at the source of my master's disquiet. This event transpired at the harbor immediately after the Spartans and Egyptian marines had completed their exchange of gifts and were making ready to take leave of one another. There arose then that interval when strangers often discard that formality of intercourse with which they have heretofore conversed and speak instead man to man, from the heart. The captain, Tamiticus, had clearly taken to my master, and the polemarch, Olympias, Alexandros's father. He summoned these now aside, declaring that he had something he wished to show them. He led them into the naval commander's campaign tent, erected there upon the strand, and with this officer's permission produced a marvel the like of which the Spartans, and of course I myself, had never beheld. This was a map. A geographer's representation not merely of Hellas and the islands of the Aegean, but of the entire world. The chart spread in breadth nearly 2 meters of consummate detail and craftsmanship, and inscribed upon Nile papyrus, a medium so extraordinary that though held to the light, one could see straight through it. Yet even the strongest man's hands could not rend it, save by first opening a tear with the edge of a blade. The marine rolled the map out upon the squadron commander's table. He showed the Spartans their own homeland in the heart of the Peloponnese, with Athens 140 miles to the north and east, Thebes and Thessaly due north of there, and Mounts Ossa and Olympus at the northernmost extremity of Greece. West of this, the mapmaker Stylus had depicted Sicilia, Italia, and all the leagues of sea and land clear to the pillars of Heracles. Yet the bulk of the chart had barely begun to be unfurled. I wish only to impress upon you for your own preservation, gentlemen. Tamiticus addressed the Spartans through his interpreter the scale of his majesty's empire and the resources he commands to bring against you, that you may make your decision to resist or not based upon fact and not fancy. He unrolled the papyrus eastward. Beneath the lamplight arose the islands of the Aegean, Macedonia, Illyria, Thrace, and Scythia, the Hellespont, Lydia, Caria, Cilicia, Phoenicia, and the Ionic cities of Asia Minor. All these nations the great king controls, all these he has compelled into his service, all these are coming against you. But is this Persia? Have we reached yet the seat of empire? Out rolled more leagues of landmass. The Egyptian's hand swept over the outlines of Ethiopia, Libya, Arabia, Egypt, Assyria, Babylonia, Sumeria, Cappadocia, Armenia, and the Transcaucasus. The fame of each of these kingdoms he recited, quoting the numbers of their warriors and the arms and armaments they carried. A man traveling fast may traverse all the Peloponnese in 4 days. Look here, my friends. Merely to get from Tyre to Susa, the great king's capital, is 3 months' march. And all that land, all its men and wealth, belong to Xerxes. Nor do his nations contend one against the other as you Hellenes love so to do, nor disunite into squabbling alliances. When the king says assemble, his armies assemble. When he says march, they march. And still, he said, we have not reached Persepolis and the heart of Persia. He rolled the map out farther. Into sight arose yet more lands, covering yet more leagues, and called by yet more curious names. the Egyptian reeled off more numbers, 200,000 from this satrapy, 300,000 from that. Greece, in the west, was looking punier and punier. She seemed to be shriveling into a microcosm in contrast to the endless mass of the Persian Empire. The Egyptian spoke now of outlandish beasts and chimera, camels and elephants, wild asses the size of draft horses. He sketched the lands of Persia herself, then Media,